Welcome to Unbreak My Chart, the podcast that tapes the top 10 and talks about it at school the next day. I'm Fraser McAlpine.
I'm Laura Snapes.
And on this week's agenda, Kesha is back and the charts have been mended, which is nice. But we begin with an email from Erin. Laura, would you like to read the email?
Yes, Erin says, "Greetings from Canada. I have to start by saying that I am fully on the Bad Liar train and it is my favourite song from the Summer Contenders, although I'm also a fan of Despacito. FYI, on the Canadian singles chart, Bad Liar is currently at number 16, this was sent last week so it might not be now, down from a high of number 11. Our chart has some similarities to yours, but Little Mix doesn't appear at all and Rita Ora is down in the 70s. I had never heard of either of them before your show. I do need your help though. You played a bit of Did You See by J-Hus a while back and the first few seconds, the sort of keys, synth, bouncy chords things are giving me the worst deja vu and I can't figure out what it reminds me of. I feel like it might have been something from the early 2000s, but otherwise I am lost. Help." So for anybody who can't remember the first few seconds of Did You See by J-Hus, they sound like this. Fraser, do you have any good ideas about what that might be?
No, I was listening to it going, well, it's, I think Trop House has just infused my head to such a degree now that I'm just like, this is everything. This is just everything. And this isn't even a Trop House song. I can't.
No, I'm also stumped. I have posted it on the Unbreak My Chart Facebook page, which thanks to everybody who signed up to that, to see if anybody has any ideas. And Sam Gavin suggests that it might be Where My Girl's At by 702, which personally I think sounds more like Bills, Bills, Bills by Destiny's Child. So if anybody has a clue, we'll come back to this next week. If you want email suggestions, you can contact us at unbreakmychartpod@gmail.com or go to the Facebook page.
We'll get to the bottom of this. Don't you worry, Erin.
So that is Praying by Kesha, which is her first proper single since her 2012 album Warrior, excluding a couple of featured spots with Pitbull and Zedd in the interim. I mean, for anybody who isn't familiar with Kesha's story over the last few years, she's been locked in a legal battle with the producer Dr. Luke after she sued him for alleged sexual assault, including claims of him slipping her a date rape drug, as well as emotional abuse, manipulation and other charges. The case hasn't really gone in her favour. In the state of California, a judge ruled in favour of Luke and his label Kemosabe, which is an imprint of Sony Records, and Luke's also sued her mother for defamation. But the case is still being heard in New York. So for a really long time, Kesha hasn't been allowed to release music, and the exact details of the conditions that have allowed her to put out Praying with an album called Rainbow following next month haven't yet been revealed. But the writer Taffy Bredessa Akner wrote a profile of Kesha for the New York Times magazine last October, and over on Twitter this week she offered some more details about what had gone on. She said this album came about as a result of the pressure from the court and the public to allow Kesha to release music, and it's the third of the five that she owes the label. But when Dr. Luke leaves Sony next month, he will take Kesha with him, and she'll be under contract with him for her next two albums. And if those albums don't come out, she'll be under contract with him forever, because he gets to decide what's to come out, so she may not be able to put out anything ever again, or she might make something, and if he believes that it is unfavourable towards him, he'll just be able to say, nah, I don't think so, we're not putting this out. Which is obviously a vile situation to be in. I think most people don't really think of pop stars as kind of capital A artists most of the time, so we don't think about how it must kind of hurt for them to be in a position where they can't release music. And there's lots of debate about what pop is and isn't, but I think obviously the audience is a crucial kind of factor. Which is an obvious thing to say because pop is short for popular, but I think it's a proper, like, if a tree falls in a wood situation for the artist. If you're making pop music and nobody's hearing it, like, is it even, like, what's the point of it? And to that point, last year, the critic Amanda Petruzic wrote a piece for The New Yorker called The Pain of Denying Kesha Her Audience, which we've linked to in the show notes. And she writes, "If her accusations are true, she now has both endured a trauma and been denied an opportunity to process or soothe that trauma via art. At best, that situation sounds terrifically lonesome. At worst, it is an entire second assault." And you should really read that whole piece, as it's brilliant and it's still highly relevant. So what has come out then in Praying is art where she is clearly dealing with the emotional effects of her ordeal, because there's not really any mistaking who it's about, which looks like freedom in one sense, but maybe not in another. So on Tuesday, I went to a playback event in London where she played 5 songs from the album to a room full of journalists and people from the record label. And it was really moving to hear her talk about these songs. She was crying quite openly and she hadn't prepared remarks or anything like that. But I kept thinking, although I'm sure that nobody from Sony in this room is directly responsible for holding you to these terms, I kind of feel so uncomfortable that they get to keep her in a painful situation and benefit from it as well. You know, she's still not allowed to talk about the specifics of the case, so kind of time will tell as to how free she actually is right now. But getting to the song, I do think it's like pretty brilliant. I think it's a bit, you know, self-consciously kind of grown up and somber, but I think she also deserves to make that move. And the bit that really gives me shivers is when that piano starts pounding, and then when she screams that brilliant high note that quickly codifies into this piercing digital whistle. It's such a stuff all of this moment. And I know, obviously, Fraser won't have watched the video, but there's a very, very good moment when that note hits. What do you make of it?
I came at it from having read, I've literally just finished reading John Seabrook's astonishing book, The Song Machine Inside the Hit Factory, which is a history of how pop music came to be made the way it is made right now over the last 15 or so years, pretty much since the Backstreet Boys, you know, that year when Max Martin started to become part of when Swedish people started to write really, really good pop songs. And the last chapter in that book is about Dr. Luke and Kesha, and it does detail the falling apart of their relationship. As part of the narrative of the book, it's made clear that as far as attention is concerned within the music business, it's always about the money. The money is where it all happens. So if the talent is in the songwriter who makes the music happen, the singers often find themselves in open conflict. Kelly Clarkson found herself in open conflict. She didn't even want to record Since You'd Be Gone. She didn't like it. It wasn't the kind of music that she liked. But Max Martin and Clive Davis forced her to. Now, you could argue that obviously did her a lot of good. But it's an interesting sort of standard to hold people to. And then, you know, Kesha's experience, which is obviously far worse, and I wouldn't want to discredit what she says happened to her in any way. But that is all being channeled into her art, which, you know, as you say, is being released on his record label, presumably having been signed off by him as being, you know, something that he wants to see released. So it's got to her every time those songs are being played or being discussed, because, you know, it either has been constructed as an artifice in order to play to the narrative that everybody is talking about by people around Dr. Luke, or by Dr. Luke, or, you know, in signed off by Dr. Luke at the very least, or it's a pure moment of complete personal expression on Kesha's part, and he's not even listening. He doesn't even care enough. So it's all of that is bound up in the music of the song, and the song is such a colossal power ballad, but it feels justified for the first time. And it's weird because we talk a lot about why authenticity matters and whether it matters, and I think both of us are pretty much coming from the same point of view, which is that in general the authenticity of an artist isn't a big problem. Like, you just want the music and the song, and all they have to do is sound like they mean it and sort of sound like they mean the thing that they're trying to get across at that moment. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to know that the story you're being told is true. Otherwise, everything in the Marvel comic universe would fall apart. Star Wars would fall apart. Harry Potter would fall apart. You know, that's the point of view I'm coming at it from. These people are creating fictions that are emotionally resonant with me as a listener. I mean, this is clearly massively emotionally resonant, but it's also true. So it's really put me on the back foot a little bit, trying to work out if I'm reacting in that emotional way because of what I know, because of what I've read, because of the book, and because of, you know, the testimony and all of the things that, you know, or whether it's all contained within the music. And obviously, with a song this that has those kind of primal qualities to it, it is contained within the music. But I, you know, some people argue the same thing about Rag and Bone Man, and I don't get it with Rag and Bone Man, or even Paloma Faith. I don't believe them when they're singing. So I'm in sort of a moment of quandary about it, because I do like the song. I just don't know whether I should like the song according to my own standards.
It does. I mean, I have pause when it comes to music that's got a big, sad backstory attached to it. It always makes me stop to think, would I have liked this, or would I have been interested in this without that backstory. For an example, from earlier this year, I did already like the artist Mount Eerie a lot, but he made an album about his wife dying from cancer at a very young age, and I would have listened to it anyway, but it made me think, oh, it's horrible that this man who's been making music and releasing it for 20, 25 years is suddenly going to have all of these new fans and new listeners and new attention because they just want to scour his music for quite how kind of painful and raw and full of grief it is. And it's, you know, when it comes to Kesha, I have to ask that question of myself because I probably would not necessarily have put on a new Kesha album when it came out. But obviously the backstory that I've been following is what makes me interested in it. But I think that the different thing here maybe is I think that she's done a great job of conveying her pain and making it universal. But one of the reasons that I think it is so powerful is because post Sia, vapid empowerment pop has become such a big thing. So much pop is about like overcoming obstacles of various shades, whether it's something tiny, like when you listen to Paris by the Chainsmokers, whoever the guy singing is painting the fact that him and his girlfriend have run away to Paris as some kind of like huge Herculean like feat, like they've overcome some great adversity. Or you can look to something like Raw by Katy Perry, which doesn't really sound like it's really got anything at its heart, but she kind of makes this great mountain out of it. And that kind of music and that kind of sentiment, I think, has become really dreary, even to the point that Sia, I've read interviews where she's kind of taking the mick out of it. When she released This Is Acting, the album of offcuts of songs that she had written for other people that they didn't ultimately want, I think she talked quite candidly then about how easy it was to knock out this sentiment and knock out songs along these lines. But yeah, and also when Pop Justice earlier this year held a competition for the best and most surprising single of 2017 to be awarded immediately on site, one of his criteria was that it couldn't contain lyrics about empowerment. So with all of that in mind and how boring that genre has become, to have a song like this come out and reassemble those tropes in a very purposeful and very sincere way, I do think is kind of radical.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention Raw by Katy Perry, actually, because in the John Seabrook book, there's a moment where I think Dr. Luke or Max Martin, it just escaped my head for a minute, is playing him Raw for the first time. No one's heard it yet. He's like, oh, I've just done this song with Katy Perry. What do you think? And he hates it. He listened to it for the first time. And he's like, well, this is nonsense. This is just vapid. There's nothing to it. And then he describes how over the following weeks as the song is released, he's heard it on the radio 10 times. And, you know, what he describes as a form of musical Stockholm syndrome. He, you know, essentially he grows to love his captor because it is what it is being constantly nice to you, even though they're saying something in a language that you don't like. You know, that what they're saying is, come on, we can overcome this adversity. And it might even be that the adversity in question, this isn't in the book, this is me interpolating wildly, but it might even be that the adversity in question is having to listen to the bloody song in the first place. That I've got to overcome this terrible adversity. What is it? Your song. And it's a song about overcoming adversity. Maybe that helps you get over that. But yeah, so it's really interesting that just devoid of any context, some of that aspirational stuff is awful on first listen, but there has to be some form of emotional context. But then you can't criticize songwriters for trying to hit people where they feel things, because that's their job. That's why so many songs are about love, because people are often thinking about that kind of thing, and a lot of people feel like they're overcoming adversity just getting up in the morning. And that is where all authenticity comes into play as a really neat way of circumnavigating. But it still has to sound like she means it. And I suppose what we're basically saying is, ooh, crikey, it really does sound like she means it.
So this week we're onto the first new chart of the new regime. This means that the official charts company's new singles rules have come in. An artist can only have 3 songs in the top 100 at any one time, its most popular songs. The artist's most popular songs, anything else will automatically be dropped out. And then a really odd mishmash of a rule that means that for most tracks, 150 streams equals 1 unit or 1 sale, or as it used to be. But now once a single has started its steady decline down the charts, its ratio will be increased, minimised, I'm not good at maths, it will become 1 to 300, so it will automatically kind of be put on the back foot. So the results of the first week of this regime, it has accurately targeted Ed Sheeran. He's the biggest loser from all of this. Last week he had 8 singles in the top 100, but now he only has 3. According to the BBC, 4 of those dropped out naturally, but the other one was excluded. Shape of You has also dropped massively, having had its ratio adjusted, as did Clean Bandit's Symphony. And as the BBC explained, there were more new entries in this week's chart than any other week in 2017, including Hailee Steinfeld's Most Girls and Alma's Chasing Highs, Rudimental's Sun Comes Up, Ollie Murr's Unpredictable, and Post Malone's Congratulations.
Oddly enough, the top 10, which is our specialised sort of area of the charts, is unchanged by all the hoopla, more or less. I'm the One is now I'm the Gone, because it's at number 11. The Bridge Over Troubled Water song continues to fall from number 5 to number 15. And Selena Gomez's Bad Liar goes up 9 places to number 25. And I promise you, I did not rig that. That's nothing to do with me. That's genuinely popularity at work. So presumably if it continues to rise only slightly over the next few weeks, it won't get booted out of the chart yet.
We've had an email from Dunstan Kessler. He says,
frustratingly opaque as the new chart rules are, I'd ended up with a different interpretation of the 3 singles in a chart rule. This is what we were discussing last week, because we couldn't work out how they would pick which songs to go into the top 10 from your album when it first comes out. Dunstan says, my take on it wasn't that an artist was allowed 3 strikes from their album and then they're out. Isn't it the 3 most popular tracks that week? Now, in reality, that's not going to make that much difference, I'd imagine. But to allay Laura's fears about the death of the music video, you could see an established artist bust out a blockbusting video from a previously uncharted song that then gets attention. And in Play Your Cards Right style, what does attention make? Streams! And charts much later than it would in the current system. As a result, we could see a welcome return of high new entry singles coming in with a bullet, as the accepted parlance of Top of the Pops insists on them doing. As you've pointed out, it's not all that clear at this point, but the thing that really leapt out at me was that these new rules had been agreed in consultation with all the major record labels. My take should mean the established artist potentially getting more chart presence over a longer period of time, given a marketing strategy designed to do so, plus lead to more opportunities for the newer artists too, a win-win for the labels, which can only be a good thing, right? And then he says, oh. I don't. Yeah, I think that's probably right. I'm not sure about the videos thing, though, because as we've discussed, it doesn't. The Galway Girl video didn't boost Galway Girl's chart presence. It existed for a reason that we're not sure about, actually. We don't know why videos. I don't know why lyric videos come out first and then real videos come out second. I don't know what the purpose of the real video is. Why? What? Which master it serves? And it's possible that we need to talk to a proper expert about this, because I don't think either of us are particularly sure what the thing does, because YouTube, as we've said many times, YouTube streams don't count towards the chart.
But they do in America, I think.
Yeah.
So that must be why.
Yeah, so it must be just the American thing. So it looks insane over here, because it doesn't boost Spotify listens of Galway Girl if you go and watch the video. I suppose Ed Sheeran is a bad role model to pick in this sense, because all of his songs were in the top 100 from the album already, whereas most artists would probably discover that they release their new album, the song that's the single is the one that's going to be in the top 40, and then in order to make any of the other songs enter the top 40 at all, they're going to have to do a big promotional push, and that probably will involve making a video. That's the normal run of things. So maybe it is that. And then obviously on a week-by-week basis, if that's the song that pushes out the two other songs that were biffing around in the bottom reaches of the top 100 because lots of people were listening to the album, that's probably fair enough.
So on to this week's top 10. At number 10 is To You by David Guetta featuring Justin Bieber. Speak from my heart when it comes to you.
At 9, it's Pretty Girl, the Cheat Codes times Cade remix by Maggie Lindemann. Just a pretty girl. Now, anyone listening to that will obviously be aware that that's a Trop House banger. Although there's more emphasis on the house in this particular iteration than in the Trop. It's sort of funny when pop music not only has a default hit sound, which is, you know, very much Trop House at the moment, but like a default melodic palette as well. There's only a series of only a few notes that pop music currently consists of. And this has those kind of Drake monotonous verses and a really nursery rhyme bridge into the chorus, which is just so very of the moment in pop music. It's remarkable. You know, it's almost like they've just taken out all the other notes that you could use and just gone, we don't use these at the moment. 2017, these five, they'll do fine.
You know what's going to happen next? By Christmas, somebody, whether ironically or sincerely, will have created an album which is Trop House remixes of the classics. Stairway to Heaven, Trop House remix. Strawberry Fields Forever, Trop House remix.
See, this plays into a theory I've had about pop music for a long time, which is the Swiss Army Knife theory, where every new musical development goes back and looks at everything else that's happened in music up until that point and tries to see whether you can meld the two things together, whether you can use this new music as a Swiss Army knife to create new tools. You know, so it would be like the equivalent of Walk This Way with hip-hop and Aerosmith, you know, and punk rock going back and investigating which songs are okay and which songs are not okay. And I think it's a constant thing that happens whenever there's a music development. So even going back as far as Nutrocker by B. Bumble and the Stingers, which is Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Suite performed as if a blazing rock and roll piano piece. So I think, yes, that's almost exactly what's going to happen. So the Swiss Army Knife thing is going to happen with Trop House.
Going back to Pretty Girl, I find it really funny that a song about the individuality of somebody's personality has found success by being remixed into literally the blandest available form. But also, I kind of think that's nothing less than what it deserves. Even if you listen to the original song, it's really, really noxious. The lyrics at the start go, I can swear, I can joke, I say what's on my mind, if I drink, if I smoke, I keep up with the guys. The whole sentiment of this song, it thinks it's being really clever and very feminist by saying, I'm not just a pretty girl, but the sentiment of it is still, I'm not like the other girls, and it's conforming to the myth of the quote-unquote cool girl, that the way to be accepted and get respect from guys is to be 100% chill and behave just like them. You know, if anybody is going to this song for the lyrics rather than the Trop House genericism, that's not a word, they would be much better off listening to Most Girls by Hailee Steinfeld, which does what this song is trying to do a billion times better by actually standing up for girls of all different kinds of identities and persuasions and impulses.
Yeah, this is the equivalent of those people that go into toy shops and slag off Barbie dolls and stuff like that. It's like, well, that doesn't help because you're still telling little girls off for the things that they genuinely like.
At number 8 is Power by Little Mix featuring Stormzy. Who got the power?
Who got the power? And at number 7 is Your Song by Rita Ora, which, given what we've just talked about, must be the most ironic song title of the year, given its total capitulation to what is currently the pop norm. It's Rita saying, this is your song. I didn't even like this music. You just gave it to me. I have to sing it. I don't want to hear sad songs anymore. I only want to hear love songs. I found my heart up in this place tonight. Don't want to sing mad songs anymore. Only want to sing your song. Cause your song's got me. Also, I've had a look at the lyrics in the first verse, and I can't, if this was a play, it would make no sense whatsoever, right? See if you can work out a line of dramatic action that in which all of the things listed within the lines of the first verse can possibly happen at the same time, right? I woke up with a fear this morning, but I can taste you on the tip of my tongue, alone without no warning. Which, I mean, we're going to just have to let that be alone without warning, because the double negative is just making it even more confusing. You're by my side and we've got smoke in our lungs. So she's woken up with what? His nose in her mouth and the room has suddenly caught fire. She's alone. She can taste whatever bits of him she's been licking in the night. And he's left her at his place and he's put round to her flat to move her sideboard. Is that she's by my side and the room is still on fire, or he's suddenly, they're in bed together and he suddenly burst into flames and that's what's burnt her tongue, that's what she could taste? It doesn't make any sense.
Can I rain on your parade?
Yeah,
I think she's probably just been snogging somebody who smoked too many cigarettes and she really needs to clean her teeth.
But she can't be alone and with him.
No, but she just flashed back. That's like the taste in her mouth. It's Proustian, apart from instead of Madeline's, it's manky old fag breath.
She can't be... All right, fine, 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 fine. But also, she doesn't say taste. She's, I know that this is poetic language. I don't think it's poetic language.
But, no, I mean, it's certainly not that poetic.
But we've got smoke in our lungs. Is that leftover smoke? That's just from the night before.
Maybe they were blowing it... Yeah, maybe they were blowing it into each other's mouths. You must have woken up after a morning of smoking too many cigarettes and felt like there was still a storm raging in your lungs.
Yes, but not with someone who was at one and the same time by my side and not there.
No, but it's a flashback. It's the taste is taking her back, is all she can think about. There are many things wrong with this song, and the lyrics are not good, but I think that the literalness of them is not one of his main problems.
Okay, okay.
Meanwhile, the next song might have a similar problem. At number 6 is Fields by Calvin Harris, featuring Pharrell Williams, Katy Perry, and Big Sean. A little souvenir. Can I steal it from you? To memorize the way you shock me. The way you move it here. Just wanna feel it from you. This song has gone up 15. I think it's this summer's Uptown Funk easily. I really, really like it. I cannot pick apart the lyrics no matter how hard I try. I don't care what any of them are saying apart from Katy Perry. And I think it's a great example of pure rhythmic pop nonsense. There's something really ungainly about the vibe. Like, I'm sure some people could do very good sexy dancing to it, but it seems like it's made for kind of slightly embarrassing, like, walk dancing down the street. And like Chained to the Rhythm, that lilting vibe that it has just snares me in immediately. And I love all the production mess in there as well. I was watching the most recent episode of Top of the Pops on rerun from 1984 on BBC4 shortly after listening to this song for the first time, and I reckon it's got a bit in common with the silliness of that era's production, but better tunes. I have to say that Big Sean's rap logs me out of it a little bit. I'd kind of prefer it if it was just Katy Perry saying "Don't be afraid to catch feels" all the time, which has become a phrase in our household, popping out from behind a door like a little cuckoo clock, saying "Don't be afraid to catch feels."
Right, it's my turn to do some raining. I hate that bit. That's the bit I hate the most. The bit where Katy Perry is so not committed to anything that she's doing. And she's always... It's that thing of when people who aren't funny make jokes and it sounds like she's trying to be funny. And it just... That bit really pulls me out of the reality of the song. I always kind of like it when it starts. And then it really throws me off by just being a little bit too lilt advert chipper. Not that pop has to be, you know, deep or even thoughtful. I just like to hear some emotional effort on behalf of the people who are making it. And really, this is just a fun loop in search of a song. It's like that I Just Can't Rely on You by Paloma Faith, which you did with Pharrell. And I sense that Pharrell, when you go to him for a song, will give you 4 bars over which he has sung 4 different melodic ideas. And people just go, that's great, that's great. We'll just chain them together in a way that seems to make the most sense. And there's the song, it's done. There's something really not constructed song reality about it that really, really bugs me. And I wrote on our running order, I don't like the Katy Perry chorus, nor is it written in block capitals with 3 exclamation marks. I love the Katy Perry chorus. This could be our first proper fight.
I do love the Katy Perry chorus, and I totally see what you're saying. It's totally a cut-and-shot pop song. It's like when you go and see... I remember the one time I ever saw the Strokes live at a festival. They all had sunglasses on. They were all facing away from each other, and it was only kind of the notes that were melding in the middle of them that kind of connected them to each other. But I'm not listening to a Calvin Harris song for a song. I kind of like the weird medley version. It doesn't feel like listening to one song. It feels like your own kind of like summer movie montage. Well, like Lord Sings, it's like a supercut of summer, and there's something quite breezy and pleasing about hearing all the little kind of bits hitting you unexpectedly. Also, we now own a CD copy of Funk Wav Bounces Vol 1, so I expect to get more obsessed with this song as summer moves on.
Well, okay. There was another fun bit in our running order today where immediately to try and justify her love of the song, Laura wrote, and I love the stupid video where she's lying in the grass lifting up her skirt as if getting with her might lead to you catching feels. And I went, wait, are we saying that feels is a sexually transmitted disease? To which Laura replied, yes, absolutely, with 4 exclamation marks this time. And that's a new justification for the lyric, you're not afraid to pop pills, apparently.
Yeah, because there's no shame in like having to pop down the doctors to get your medicine the next day. Look, I think all of these pop songs, Feels and the Rita Ora one, they're very practical.
And they're really good on the grim realities of copping off, aren't they? They're pretty good on the kind of the non-romantic moments, the smell on your breath and the unfortunate sexually transmitted diseases that you might pick up along the way. So don't be afraid to catch antibiotic-resistant gonorrhea, or feels, as we're now calling it.
A song I certainly have antibiotic resistance to is at number 5, and it is Strip That Down by Liam Payne featuring Quavo. You know I love it when the music's loud, but come on, strip that down for me, baby. Now there's a lot of people in the crowd, but only you can dance with me. So put your hands on my body and swing that crown for me, baby. You know I love it when the music's loud, but come on, strip that down for me.
And at number 4 is Mama by Jonas Blue featuring William Singe.
At number 3 is Unforgettable by French Montana featuring Swae Lee.
And at number 2, Wild Thoughts by DJ Khaled featuring Rihanna and Bryson Tiller. Just keep it white and black as if I'm your sister. I'm too hip to hop around time I hit with ya. I know I get wow, wow, wow. Wow, wow.
A friend of mine is really obsessed with this song, and she kept asking me if I had heard it, and I didn't listen to it for a number of weeks, but I don't like it. I don't get it. Like, it could be all right, but it sounds really dated to me. It sounds like 2002 and Ricky Martin and Shakira, and I mean, it could be all right, but then that big hoary Santana like solo bit comes in. The only bit that I like is, and let's not get into the specifics of it, but just how Rihanna says, I know you want to see me nakey, nakey, naked. Nakey, nakey is not a phrase I've heard since I was a small child and used to, you know, shout it running around the garden at my brothers. So for that, well done.
I've listened to the whole of the DJ Khaled album in the week, and I didn't realise, and this is, again, this is my own ignorance, you know, there are lots of massive hip-hop fans out there that are like, well, duh. Every single time he does a song, he starts it with one of three samples, in fact, all three of the samples, another one, and then there's, if you listen to any of the songs that he's got in the charts, they all start with the same three vocal bits, which, DJ Khaled, and a whole album of that is impossibly wearing. You're just like, seriously, I already know you made the album. I chose to listen to the album. Who is so insecure that they need to put that at the beginning of every track in case the track is taken out and used in a different context and people weren't 100% sure of who it was that produced it?
I was reading this about this album today, and I mean, it's not an album that I would listen to, but one of the reasons that he's doing that at the start of every song, this album is completely dedicated to his infant son. He's on the front cover. The kid has got an executive production credit. I think he's like 1 year old or something.
Oh, he's mentioned within the music as well. He pops up.
I think possibly there are 23 songs on the album because the kid's birthday is October 23rd or something like that. But I think a lot of the shout outs at the beginning are just him reaffirming how much he loves his kid, which is delightful. But like you say, he could just stick them on in a single edit. The persistence of him doing it on every song reminds me of my favourite heckle of all time. Just when I went to an ATP festival about 10 years ago, and a poor folky songwriter lady was playing, and she did one song, and one of my more obnoxious friends shouted, "One more!" Which is very uncharitable.
Yes.
Anyway, so still at number 1, to nobody's surprise, is Despacito by Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee featuring Justin Bieber. Despacito, quiero respirar tu cuello despacito. Deja que te diga cosas al oído para que te acuerdes si no estás conmigo.
Following on from last week's revelations from the teenagers in my house that they sing Jeff Cepedo to the chorus of this song, I saw a parody of the song in the week. Which was sent to me by my daughter, who said, do you think that this version is as good as ours? And it's, I mean, I'll be frank, it's not. It's awful. And it takes pot shots at Bieber for just because they don't like him. And that's fine. I don't particularly either. But it quickly runs out of steam and resorts to the same lazy Doritos, burritos, kind of faux Spanish, ha ha ha, don't foreigners say funny words nonsense that Justin Bieber copped a lot of flack for when he did it a few weeks ago. And I know that it's his song and it's different, but their lyric is like, we hated you from the moment you brought us those tacos, and even though we ate them, we ordered burritos, just because they need the words that sound vaguely Spanish to go in the bits that are actually in Spanish. And the guy was gurning all the way through it to try and make it look funnier. All of this has just made me appreciate the genius of Dorito. Oh my God. Should we ever have a blooper reel? That's going well in there. All of this has only made me appreciate the genius of Despacito all the more.
So, this week's new releases. First up is Get Low by Zedd featuring Liam Payne. I was momentarily hopeful earlier this week because I saw that Pop Justice had done a post saying that this was surprisingly brilliant, at least compared to Strip It Down. But I disagree, Peter. You are wrong. It is exactly as creepy and horrible as that awful Sipping Bacardi song. And if I distance myself from what Liam Payne is singing about, maybe the music has some similarities with Years and Years, who I love, so I could just about give it that. But, I mean, it's a funny one, like, when you talk about stripping away identities, because this song, although Zedd has had a lot of success on his own terms, it will get big because it's Liam Payne, but also his identity couldn't matter any less to it. He is effectively a new dad with a significantly older girlfriend, but he's singing sleazy club party jams. I'm not saying that he should be taking, like, the Brian McFadden route of lifting up his finger and watching football on TV because that's what's real to me, but also he's far, far too straight-laced to be selling saucy party jams like this.
It's funny, isn't it? Because essentially what we're saying, I do agree, it's weird sleaze from someone who isn't a weird sleaze. But that means that authenticity is back on the table as a thing that we have to pay attention to because we don't believe him. You know, ultimately, Liam Payne is saying stuff because that's what pop stars say in party jams about getting off with girls or getting physical and intimate. Like, he's playing a part and it doesn't work. And yet, people are reading all sorts of unintended sauciness into Niall Horan's song because he seems to be saying it the way that Niall Horan would say it, and that seems to be what makes the most sense. So let's move on to something a lot nicer. Don't Delete the Kisses is the new song by Wolf Alice. We've already discussed Wolf Alice a few weeks ago when John was in as their rowdy song Yuck Foo was his most listened to track of the week, and I always thought that from when their album came out last year, I've had a bit of a soft spot for Wolf Alice because they're just this, as we've said at the time on the podcast, they are a 1980s old school indies, or even an early 90s old school indie band making that music. I don't really care about their means of production, but certainly the music that they play is it comes from that wellspring. But the weird thing about this song is it doesn't sound like that at all. It's an entirely different sonic arena for the band to suddenly wander into, but it still has that kind of, hey, we can do whatever the hell we like, we're bloody Wolf Alice, what do you care about it, which is utterly charming. And I think I'm charmed by it as well because I think that there's no commercial reason for them to do this as a band. They had been carving out their niche well as, you know, as a rowdy indie guitar type band, and then to make a song that sounds this odd is for them is utterly admirable. What do you think, Laura?
I do think that like Wolf Alice have got the reputation as like a grunge band, which may well come from their live performances, which are heavier. But I think that it kind of does them a disservice. Like, even if you look back at their first album, My Love Is Cool, there's all sorts of stuff going on there. I think there's a lot more to them. I think pivoting from that, you know, really screamy song Yuck Foo to this song, which is quite dreamy and romantic, I think is probably a good way of them saying to people, no, we are not just this one thing. I really, really like this song. I'm not usually a big fan of dreamy music, but this really, like, even before I read the lyrics or anything like that, it really got me. And in a way, it kind of reminds me of like Greenlight by Lord or New York by St. Vincent, in that the choruses and the verses are so different from each other, they could come from separate songs. You've got that bit where she's kind of muttering lyrics about feeling anxious about a new love, contrasted with this chorus where she kind of lets out all of her frustration over it. I really like the way that the chorus changes as well. Like, the first time you hear it, she's singing, what if it's not meant to be love? But then by the end, she's singing, you and I were meant to be in love. But yeah, I think it's great. More power to them.
Okay, let's move on to our most streamed songs of the week. Laura, would you like to start?
Yes, my most streamed song this week is Equestrian by Omni. Would you like the men Omni are an Atlanta punk trio. They had an album out last year called Deluxe, which I really liked, and they are releasing a new one called Multitask in September, and this is the first single. Just reminds me of Orange Juice and Devo and driving around country lanes in cars with broken suspension. I think it's ace. What's yours?
Mine is a new Coldplay song, Aliens. Now, listening to that, you could probably tell it's one of the very few pop songs to have been written in the time signature 5/4. The most famous hit song that has been written in that signature is Dave Brubeck's Take 5. And this is the lead track off of Coldplay's new EP, which languishes under the single least inspired name for a collection of songs ever, Kaleidoscope. The EP also features the very teardrop by Massive Attack song, All I Think About Is You, which went to YouTube a couple of weeks ago. But this particularly struck with me because this is Coldplay going a bit jazz and going off the beaten track, and they've lost their super pop aspirations just for a moment. And they're doing it, I think, in order to find the innocent spirit of their first album, Parachutes, which is utterly lovely. And they're making a really good fist of it. They seem to be discovering what it is that was slightly weird about them as a band in the first place. I mean, the weird thing about it now is if they'd kept releasing songs like this instead of becoming a kind of pop U2 and reaping that particular whirlwind of international success, they'd have definitely split up by now in the face of mounting public disinterest. Because there were loads of bands around, you know, in the early 2000s that were making slightly skewed and dreamy, emotional, pillow soft pop music that sounded like indie music. It was a thing. And so it would be really interesting to see whether this charts, bearing in mind the very last thing that that Chris Martin put his name to was the only song to hold out against the sheer insingularity. But I find it utterly charming for all that as well. I just think all these factors are, you know, are important, but I still think it's a lovely song.
Excellent. Also, every time a new like pop banger comes out and I tweet about it, I get a small number of people saying to me, is this that song that you were talking about a few weeks ago? None of them have been so far, but unless the record label's plans have changed, that song is coming out on Friday. So we will finally be able to discuss it next week. And I really hope I haven't over-egged this because people have been asking me every week since I said it, what, 10 weeks ago?
Yeah.
And also, Fraser, I'm sorry to tell you, I'm going to force you to watch the video because I think that is possibly what got me so excited about it in the first place.
Now, come on, that just proves my point about videos, which is that they stir your emotions up using means that aren't to do with the music. But okay, I will watch it.
I mean, that's true, but I think that might be how it got me. I think this video is going to be a huge cultural moment, but I will say that the video doesn't have any narrative, so it won't be steering you that way. It is a series of highly compelling images, as of course any video should hope to be.
Wow, that sounds revolutionary. I'm really looking forward to these master media manipulators and their great new visual ideas for music.
I still think it's great. I've listened to the song again since the first time I heard it, and I'm going to stick to my guns and I'm still going to say it is a great song. It may not be the song of the summer, but it is a very exciting one. And it is a different side of an exciting artist.
Excellent. I mean, it could hardly be Bad Liar by Selena Gomez, but I'm looking forward to whatever it is. It's going to be great. Thanks for listening and subscribing to Unbreak My Chart. We've reached the end of this week's show, of course. If you have anything you'd like to discuss about chart music, please contact us at unbreakmychartpod@gmail.com.
And as ever, if you want to listen to any of the songs we've discussed in this week's podcast, the best ones are in our rolling Spotify playlist, which is linked in the show notes. Also, if you go to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/unbreakmychart, we made a Songs of the Summer Spotify playlist as well, which is linked a few posts down if you wanted to subscribe to that, and we'll keep adding things to it as well. Also, we'd love it if you left us a review on Apple Podcasts, and thanks so much to everybody who has done that already.
And as always, you can find us both on Twitter. Laura is at Laura Snapes and I'm at CSI_popmusic. See you next week.
Bye.